afternoon.
Richard Hines of Ashby & Geddes for appellants to the State of Sao Paulo and the Republic of Panama. I'd like to introduce my co-counsel, John Wise, of Fowler, Rodriguez, and Chalos in New Orleans, Louisiana. Mr. Wise has been admitted in pro hoc vice and will be making the argument this afternoon on behalf of the appellants.
Good afternoon and welcome.
First of all, I'd like to thank the court for the opportunity to have this argument pro hoc vice. I appreciate it. It's a great honor. I'd also like to ask that I have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, the clock will turn orange, but it will keep going when you get to your rebuttal time, and it will be your choice whether you want to use it then or save it.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Basically, what this case is about, the context that it comes to this court, is on a motion to dismiss, where the issue that we're here about today is whether the Superior Court erred or not in finding that Panama and Sao Paulo cannot establish proximate cause on the part of the defendants for the damages that were alleged in their complaints. And specifically, these are the expenditures that these two sovereign states incurred for years treating smoking-related illnesses of their citizens. In thinking about this oral argument, I was trying to distill what the real central issue is before coming here, and it seems to me that the issue is proximate cause, but it's about really more where to draw the line. And you're confronted with different jurisprudence from different jurisdictions which have dealt separately or differently from with the same facts and the same issue. And I want to get to that in a moment. But first, as a preliminary matter, when a case arises in the context of a motion to dismiss, every allegation the plaintiffs have made in each of their complaints has to be accepted as true. And in this context, that means that you have to accept as true for purposes of the motion that we'll be able to establish that the defendants manipulated levels of nicotine, that they made their products more addictive on purpose, that they hid evidence of its harmful effects, that they marketed it to minors in these countries, that they knew that a certain percentage of the people in Sao Paulo and in Panama would get sick and would acquire smoking-related illnesses, and that they knew that the plaintiffs would have to incur the cost of their care as a result of this. All of that is pled. All of that would have to be admitted for the purpose of this motion to dismiss. And the significance of that would seem to be that defendant's conduct for purposes of this discussion is unquestionably a cause in fact of the plaintiff's harm. It's certainly a but-for cause.
Can you explain to me, just so I understand the theory of your case, let's assume a hypothetical smoker who ultimately gets medical treatment, but a person, I don't know, make him a scientist, make him whatever you want, but somebody who had absolute, complete, full knowledge of all the risks, dangers of smoking and purposely chose to engage in that conduct knowing that he would die from it. Is that a case where you are seeking to recover the medical expenses for that type of plaintiff as well, or injured party as well?
Well, we're not trying to recover for the damages that were incurred directly by any particular individual plaintiff. It's actually the damages that are incurred by the nation as a result of its obligation under its Constitution to provide for the health care of all of its citizens. Now, in answer to your question, will there be some individuals in Panama who were cognizant and intelligent and had all the facts available to them and smoked anyway? I'm sure that there must be. I mean, I can't imagine that there's not some person sophisticated there who wouldn't fit that criterion.
Okay, but doesn't this deprive your cause of action, deprive the tobacco company of the defense that they could assert to the individual's claim, because it never gets adjudicated, because it's just sort of pulled into the mix that, yes, there's people who knew they would be harmed, got harmed, but that doesn't matter?
Well, in terms of if these were all subrogation cases of, 500 people from Panama and 1,000 people from Sao Paulo, and the claims had been paid by the state as though it were an insurer, and then it was conventionally subrogated and then pursued those claims, well, you could look at them individually.
Well, if there were a subrogation claim, then the defenses
that would be available against an individual lawsuit for personal injury would be available.
That's correct. Right. And in answer to your question, you know,
But that's not this case.
That's not this case. That's right. It's I think the answer is, the defendants have raised this in their brief, that we were deprived of the opportunity to say comparative fault or assumption of the risk or these sorts of things. And in fact, the Superior Court stated, one of the things it stated in its opinion was that plaintiff's injuries only related to the defendants via the actions or inactions of their citizens. And I suppose, in answer to your question, there's going to be a few people that applies to, but really, when we're talking about a claim of a sovereign and the interest in the health and welfare of its people at large, I think you're going to get a much, much larger group of people who are victims of secondhand smoke. Let's take them as an example, people who didn't act or not act, who still got lung cancer or smoking-related illnesses, minors. I mean, part of this whole case is the fact that tobacco marketing in these countries is targeted to minors, that they try to get people addicted at an early age when they don't have any choice and where, therefore, defenses of assumption of the risk or comparative fault don't apply. It's an addictive disease, and it's a deliberate attempt to make people addicted. So when you think about those sorts of things, that might be defenses, traditional defenses in negligence or, you know, to negligence claims as opposed to intentional acts of a company to target those types of people that are going to be addicted, people that are minors, those sorts of things. Does assumption of the risk and comparative fault really have anything to do with that?
I'm having trouble following your answer to Justice Richley's question, which was simply, in a case like this, which is not a subrogation claim, would the defenses, would the tobacco companies have or not have the defenses that would be available if the plaintiffs were the injured smokers?
Well, they certainly have a right to defend the merits of whether they did anything wrong. I mean, they you can certainly argue whether anything that is
yeah, but assumption of the risk, contributory negligence, those types of defenses would not be available. Is that
well,
correct?
Not on a case-by-case basis, because this isn't brought in that context. This is brought in the overall cost of the health care that's being paid by Panama. In other words,
the answer is no.
Well, that's correct. In that sense, that's right. But
this is a case brought under common law of torts. Would you agree?
Well, that's among other things. I mean, we also pled other causes of
action.
That's
what's before us, correct?
Torts, that's right, as well as unjust enrichment.
All right. And if the plaintiffs, contrary to what that is counterfactually, were the smokers who got sick, if they were the plaintiffs, I suppose that any duty that was owed would be easily articulable under tort law. Correct?
Correct.
That is, there would be a duty on the part of the tobacco companies not to take actions that they knew or should have known would be injurious to the smoking public.
Correct.
What is the duty owed to the government? That is, the foreign governments who, let's assume, have an obligation under their own laws to provide for the treatment of persons who were injured by the tobacco company. How would you articulate that duty under common law, common tort law?
Well, it's got to arise in their capacity as a parens patriae. In other words, a government like Sao Paulo or Panama, just like the states of the United States argued, you know, has a quasi-sovereign or sovereign capacity where they have an interest in the health and welfare of their nation.
How do you articulate the duty that's owed by the tobacco company?
I think the
duty that's being violated, you allege.
Well, the duty is going to be very similar in that sense that they owe a duty, knowing that their product can cause this type of harm, and knowing that they have information which could have been disseminated years earlier to these countries. That they not do that. The ambit of protection that's provided by their duty extends not only to individuals, but it extends to nations and states and their parens patriae capacity, because they're the only people who are actually going to suffer this harm, because all the indigents and the people who are receiving the medical care in Panama They're not suffering monetary harm. They're, you know, because their health care is paid for by their government. But the government certainly suffer the harm, and the governments, you know, are going to suffer in their treasuries, you know, and that's going to be, you know, where do their treasuries come from the taxes that they levy.
Is it your position that the governments here are suing as parents patriae?
Yes.
Is that essential to your position?
Is it essential?
If we were to disagree with you, is the case over?
No, I don't think so. I think it makes it easier for you to agree with me.
But if because there is no parens patriae doctrine that applies here, then the governments would have to sue in their own right as an injured party.
Well, that's
full
correct.
Breach of duty.
That's correct.
All right. If the government is suing as parens patriae, then I suppose you can argue that the duty that's being violated is the same duty that is owed to the individuals, that is, the citizens. But if parents patriae is not available, then the foreign governments have to have a distinct injury. That is, they have to be complaining of a violation of a distinct duty owed to them. And that's my problem. I'd like you to articulate what the distinct duty owed to them would be when they're not suing as parents patriae.
Well, the government, I'm not sure that I'll go with you on that. I understand what your question is, but whether you go with me or not, answer my question. Sure, and I'm trying to do that. I mean, I think that basically when you're talking about tort and duty, I mean, that can take many, many forms. I mean, the fact that they're parents patriae is what distinguishes them. That's I guess the reason that argument is important in this context is because of all of the healthcare cases that you'll hear about from the other side, which is that, you know, you've got insurance companies and you've got labor union pension funds and things like that, and there are cases where they have been denied the right to proceed, you know, because they are deemed to be too remote. And parents patriae is important in the sense that special relationship exists on behalf of the nation towards its citizens.
That's fine. Now, I asked you to assume that parents patriae is not
apply
in the case.
Then it's just a straight tort case. I mean,
then
you have to articulate
what is the duty that's owed to the government when it's suing in its own right, not as parents patriae on behalf of its citizens?
The duty is basically to not go down into these countries and export something that's going to cause this type of harm and cause this kind of economic loss to those countries that don't have the resources to do what, you know, the United States governments can do.
So the rule of law would be that if tobacco companies market their products in the way that they did in foreign countries, they owe duties under tort law not only to their customers, that is, the individuals who buy and use the cigarettes, but also to their governments.
Well, I think that's correct. I think that's correct. I mean, it's in a sense the what I wanted to get into a little bit is the fact that the sovereign in these cases, certainly in Panama and Sao Paulo, is really about the only person who can assert the claim for the remedy. If you don't have the sovereign asserting this claim, then is a remedy even available elsewhere? I mean, they have an interest in the health and well-being of their citizens to the point that they provide their health care and they have to deal with the increased health care cost. If they're not the proper party to bring it, if they're not the one who can assert it, then is there any remedy available for any of this action? You have a intentional tort without a remedy.
Well, what about a class action?
Well, a class action would proceed. There wouldn't be a class action in Panama. I don't really know that vehicle even exists. So you'd have to have a class action of individual Panamanians with smoking-related illnesses, which would have to be brought up here, presumably.
What's wrong with that?
Well, I guess first of all, they'd have to have the ability to go and proceed to do that. I mean, what is the likelihood that any of these individual impoverished Panamanians that get free health care are going to be able to find lawyers that will represent them in a class action in the United States? I mean, I don't think it's very realistic. I mean, you know, essentially, the sovereign is here to protect those interests. They're not here to get the same damages. I mean, obviously, And that's another issue. I mean, it is that, you know, there's not an overlap of damages in this situation. They're not here seeking pain and suffering damages for individual Panamanians. They're seeking the recompense for what has happened economically here in the sense of having to pay for all of this extra health care.
When we talk about a duty to the government, is there a correlative duty to mitigate on the part of the government? I mean, couldn't the government make the sale of tobacco illegal? Couldn't the government set up statutory remedies in its own jurisdiction? Couldn't the government do all kinds of things to protect its citizens and limit its own damages as opposed to coming to the United States to litigate?
Well, those are all good arguments to be made at some later stage of the proceeding, but I don't think they're threshold issues to their right to bring a suit. I think that, yes, I mean, that's an argument that I'm sure that will be made by the defendants, and that will have to be the subject of discovery and find out whether any of those things actually are true or could have been done. I mean, certainly things have changed in the last 10 years in these countries. I mean, you know, as more information becomes available, you know, then more steps are taken by the countries to educate their citizens. But essentially, they're 30 or 40 years behind the United States. I mean, they're still living in the age of the Marlboro Man and celebrities, you know, being used to market cigarettes and cigarettes being marketed towards underage people.
You know, is that contributory negligence on the part of the governments?
To the extent that the governments are able to know and understand and keep up, you know, but the bottom line is that they're behind the curve, and part of the reason they're behind the curve is because of the fact that tobacco deliberately withheld it. And the only reason that some of those changes occurred here in the United States was due to some of those suits that were filed by the attorney generals of 46 states, which led to a massive settlement. And so I guess the philosophical question we have to decide is, if states have a quasi-sovereign interest which permits them to do that and permits them to take it to that point, in the state of Texas case, which we cited, certainly indicated that they did, and then settlements occurred, and of course that ends the discussion of that. But, you know, then why does not a neighboring country sovereign have the same right to assert that type of claim? And we say that they do. I mean, well, one of the last things I wanted to say before I got to stop here for my 2 minutes of rebuttal. In looking at the issue of proximate cause, I know sometimes we all think we know what it means and where it comes from, but it's a pretty elusive concept. And in the Blue Cross Blue Shield case, Judge Weinstein cited Prosser, and it's a very interesting couple of sentences which I think are very important. It says, proximate cause, in itself an unfortunate term, is merely the limitation which the courts have placed upon the actor's responsibility for the consequences of the actor's conduct. Some boundaries must be set to liability for the consequences of any act upon the basis of some social idea of justice or policy. And then he goes on to state, this limitation is to some extent associated with the nature and degree of the connection, in fact, between the defendant's act and the events of which the plaintiff complains. That's what we've been talking about. But it says, often to greater extent, however, the legal limitation on the scope of liability is associated with policy, with our more or less inadequately expressed ideas of what justice demands, of what is administratively possible and convenient. And that, to me, is an important issue in this case. What is our policy about American companies that export things that we've determined are wrong in the United States and that we've allowed states to proceed with claims on? Do we want to say that we're denying at a motion-to-dismiss level, not on a summary judgment or after discovery level where things can be fleshed out, you know, do we want to deny them access to even assert those claims? And I submit that we don't. And I'll reserve my last minute and a half.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. R.J. Skaggs, Morris Nichols, Arston Tunnel for Appalese, Philip Morris USA, and Altria Group, Inc. I'd like to introduce my co-counsel seated at council table of the firm of Goodwin Proctor, LLP, David R. Zips, and Kenneth J. Parsegan. Mr. Parsegan will present the argument.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Thank you for letting me appear pro hac vice today. I want to start by making clear the posture of this case in the context of cases just like it. 36 foreign governments filed suits like these in the United States. And although my colleague suggests that there are only two other cases that have been dismissed like this, that's just not correct. There were seven countries that had their suits dismissed: Guatemala, Nicaragua, Ukraine, the province of Ontario, Venezuela, the Brazilian state of Espirito Santo, and Ecuador. Those were all dismissed. 28 others voluntarily dismissed.
On grounds of proximate cause?
All of them on motions to dismiss, just like this one, because their direct injury, they couldn't establish direct injury, their injuries were too remote, failure to establish proximate cause as a matter of law. Same argument in every case, same basis. None of those cases found any distinction between foreign government suing and union health and welfare funds suing. Anybody whose sole injury is that they paid for or provided medical treatment for someone else who was the direct victim of the alleged tort, anyone in that position has had their claim dismissed.
So it's unnecessary to address the parens patriae?
I believe it is unnecessary. However, parens patriae does not apply here, and that would have been my very second point, is to go right to it. Parens patriae does
before
not.
Before you do, you started to say something about 28 other cases. Yeah. What happened to them?
The 28 others have been were voluntarily dismissed when, essentially, the die was cast. They saw that it was clear that we've had 16 appellate decisions in cases like these. Suits by the states, by the U.S. states, suits by union health and welfare funds, suits by the Navajo tribe, suits by insurers, suits by employers, all third parties who either paid for or provided medical treatment for others. 16 appellate courts have ruled in 20 decisions. Every single one has found the claims dismissed on remoteness grounds, including the two U.S. states that got two appellate decisions. There were a number of U.S. state decisions at the trial court level, but when they got to the highest court of the state, actually three times, in Florida, the Florida Supreme Court said, you have a special statute, Florida, and that special statute gets you around it. But at common law, before the statute, you would have had no such right. In Minnesota, same ruling, no common law right for the state, even, to bring a claim for providing medical treatment for people who were the direct victims of torts. So in Iowa, the Iowa Supreme Court made the same finding. The United States itself has brought such a claim nearly 60 years ago in the Standard Oil case, 1947 U.S. Supreme Court case. The United States government brought a suit saying this truck had hit a soldier, and they had to provide the treatment, medical treatment, for the soldier. The U.S. Supreme Court said no direct cause of action, even for the United States government in its own courts, because the injury is too remote. You can sue in subrogation, or you can pass a statute that gives you the right, but you have no common law right.
Mr. Persigan, I recognize that this case and the others that you've discussed in your brief all went off on the on proximate causation, remoteness, and I'm curious as to why the issue of wasn't addressed as to whether or not there was a duty owed at all, putting aside the element of proximate cause.
Yes, Justice Jacobs, a number of cases did talk a little bit about the lack of a duty, but I think they found that the whole concept of duty and proximate causation and remoteness of injury are interrelated, and they wound up that the case law, I think, they found easier to apply as a matter of remoteness. And one might say,
interrelated,
for example,
or conflated.
Well, that's fair. I think conflated is fair. If we look at duty, the injury is remote because there's no direct duty owed by the defendant to the government. The duty, as you noted, is directly to the consumer. Then the consumer gets injured, and the consumer goes to the hospital or the employer or the government or the union health and welfare fund to get treatment or get it paid for. So the duty runs through the smoker in the same way that the injury runs through the smoker. And so I think they recognized it, and there was some discussion in some of the cases about the lack of a direct duty, but in the end I think they just found that the existing case law, the easiest path for sort of analyzing it, was through injury rather than duty. But I see them as getting to the same spot for the same reasons.
What about the Attorney General's suits? That seemed to be successful. At least they got a result.
Well,
why were they not thrown out immediately?
Everyone that got to an appeals court was thrown out, as I just explained. Minnesota, Iowa, and Florida. They were thrown out on common law grounds. Now, Florida raises another issue that happened with those cases, which is many states passed a special statute. Florida did that. Maryland did that. Massachusetts did that. Colorado did that. A number of states passed a statute that said, literally said, we are creating a new cause of action for the state. Sometimes they even said only against tobacco companies, that will allow them to circumvent traditional common law rules. In fact, a number of them even went on to expressly state, we are expressly wiping out traditional defenses. We are expressly authorizing the state to sue solely on statistics. So
is it the case that the massive litigation involving some 40 states or whatever it was, all of those states had such legislation?
No, the other instance that occurred, the Third Circuit, in ruling on these cases, distinguished the state cases this way. It said every state either passed such a statute or had the threat of passing such a statute. That's how the Third Circuit distinguished it, and most courts, when they tried to distinguish the state cases, brought that up. But there's another significant difference that arises at least out of the state of Texas case, which is the states could at least argue that they had parents patriae standing. Foreign governments cannot make that argument. Okay? The law is very clear. The reason that states have parents patriae standing, parents patriae standing is based on a quasi-sovereign interest. What happened is when the states joined the union, they gave up certain sovereign powers in order to join the union. And parents patriae is a doctrine that says because you gave up certain sovereign powers, you will have special standing to act on behalf of the welfare of your citizens. Now, it's important to note there are limitations on that even for the states.
Is there a case that explains that history?
Yes, the First Circuit decision of DeCoster, which is cited as Estados Unidos versus DeCoster. It's a suit by Mexican government. And it's in the First Circuit, and it's cited in our brief. I don't have the cite off the top of my head. But it does go through the history of why the states gave up their certain level of sovereignty, and that's why they get that standing. It also makes expressly clear that foreign governments do not have that standing. The D.C. Circuit made the exact same finding in the Guatemala case. Okay? What did the plaintiffs say in response to the First Circuit and the D.C. Circuit? They're wrongly decided. That's it. There are no cases in the United States, none, that have ever found a parents patriae standing on behalf of a foreign government, with the exception of one District of Columbia trial court decision that they cite that mentions it in a footnote that has clearly been overruled by the D.C. Circuit decision in Guatemala many years later, where it expressly found there is no parents patriae standing for a foreign government. And I would add that that footnote in that trial court decision cites another circuit court decision, Pfizer versus Lord, which also expressly found that there was no parents patriae standing.
Isn't there at least an analogy as to submission or to the sovereignty of American courts? Obviously, the courts here have the authority to order the parties in this case to do certain things or not do certain things. Why isn't that, in a way, by analogy, sort of a joining of the American justice system that would allow for parents patriae?
Well, Justice Ridgely, what they gave up What the states gave up was the ability, for example, to negotiate with a treaty with the federal government. They joined in the federal government. What these countries have, what any foreign country has the right to do, is to come negotiate a treaty as a sovereign, because they haven't given up any sovereign rights. They can negotiate a treaty that says, hey, we want reciprocity. We'll let you have certain special standing in our courts if you give us special standing in your courts. Foreign governments have the ability to do that. States do not have the ability to do that. Because states don't have that ability, they get the parens patriae standing. But I think it's very important to step back from that for a minute and understand that parens patriae is only a doctrine of standing. It still doesn't change the fact that their injury is too indirect. Even for the U.S. states, the case they principally rely on is a case by the Supreme Court called SNAP. SNAP makes very clear that the states only have parens patriae standing to assert claims for injunctive relief. They've never allowed the states to recover damages for providing medical treatment to anyone. And the only case that suggests you might be able to do that is the state of Texas case, which, number one, has been effectively overruled by a Fifth Circuit decision, which said that anyone who provides provides medical treatment for a third party does not have a direct cause of action. Number two is inconsistent with the Supreme Court decision in Alfred E. Snapp, and is also inconsistent with the D.C. Circuit's decision in Guatemala, where they made clear not only that foreign governments don't have parens patriae standing, but that even if you do have it, you still have to prove a direct injury. All it lets you do, all parens patriae standing lets you do, is say, I can claim that a loss to the health and welfare of my people is an injury to me. It gives me standing to raise the injury. But you still have to show it's a direct injury in order to recover anything, and they can't show directness here.
Would there be anything to prevent Panama from passing a statute to create a claim here?
Here in the U.S.?
To create a claim with respect to the tobacco industry.
They could absolutely pass a law in their countries to create standing for them, just like the states did. They have the same power the states do in their own courts. What they don't have the power to do is to turn Delaware into the courthouse to the world, as the court that decided the Venezuela case noted they couldn't do with Miami-Dade County. They don't have that right, and frankly, neither does anybody. Within their own sovereignty, they can exercise sovereign powers and give themselves special rights the way the states did. But they, for whatever reason, have chosen not to do that. They've chosen to come to the U.S. and try to get the U.S. courts to allow them rights greater than the U.S. government and greater than U.S. states and greater than U.S. insurers and greater than anyone else in the U.S. who pays for or provides medical treatment for third parties. They don't have greater rights than all those entities in our courts, only in their own courts where they've chosen not to sit. I just want to touch very, very briefly on one other thing because it's in their brief. They didn't really mention an argument, but they talk about unjust enrichment being different. They say that unjust enrichment doesn't have a direct injury requirement. They say that Guatemala didn't have an unjust enrichment claim. And there are a few points I want to make about that. First of all, in most of the circuit court decisions that have gone our way, nine circuit courts have thrown cases like these out, seven state appellate courts. There were unjust enrichment claims, and we've cited them all in the brief. They all say no difference. You still have to show direct injury. But it's significant that even in the Guatemala case, there was a companion case. The D.C. Circuit decided two remoteness cases together. One was a suit by a union health and welfare fund, the service workers industry, and the other is Guatemala. They just go by the joint name of Guatemala because it was the first case. The Union Health and Welfare Fund did have an unjust enrichment claim, and the D.C. Circuit said, no, barred, injuries too remote. So even the Guatemala court found that the direct injury requirement applies to unjust enrichment. And I thought it was worth noting, given that their principal reliance is on the trial court decision in the state of Texas. And in that case, the state of Texas had an unjust enrichment claim. And here's what that court that they rely on said about unjust enrichment. It is the individual smokers and not the defendants who have received primary and direct benefit of the payment of their medical expenses. Moreover, the state's expenditures cannot be said to have enriched defendants. And therefore, the court finds that the alleged benefit enjoyed by defendants is too attenuated and indirect to find support under the theory of unjust enrichment. So even in the cases they rely on, the courts recognize that unjust enrichment has a direct injury requirement, just like any other tort does, and that they can't meet it, and it's barred as a matter of law. And I think what that little snippet from their case tells us is exactly something that Your Honors were getting at, which is why these cases don't make any sense. I've already told you that they don't, and that every appellate court that has looked at it has agreed, and I expect that given that the common law of proximate cause in Delaware is exactly the same as the common law of proximate cause in virtually every other state, that there's no reason for a different decision here. But the underlying principle is something that you hit at. It's fairness in presenting a defense. Yes, they are saying that even people who fully knew and fully made a choice to smoke, if they came in and got treatment by their hospitals, they want to recover for them. That is what they're saying. And they're saying more than that. They're saying not only that defendants can't raise assumption of the risk and contributory negligence and awareness and choice, they can't even raise alternative causation. They're saying you don't get to go in and look at what actually caused any person's injury. We don't have any obligation to prove what caused anybody's injury. We're going to do it purely by statistics at 100,000-foot level that will wipe out all those defenses. Some of the states expressly gave themselves the right to do that. They passed a statute. Those got challenged, some cases, whether it was constitutional or not, but that's another issue. They want to change 300 years of common law, they can go back to their countries, they can pass a statute that gives them special rights, and they can fight it out in their courts. What they can't do is come to the U.S. and say they have greater rights in our courts than everybody else, including the U.S. government. They have to play by the same rules that have stood the test of time. And unless the court has any other questions, I'll rely on the briefs and on the decisions of the unanimous decisions of the 16 appellate courts that have considered these questions.
Thank you.
Briefly, Your Honors, in response to opposing counsel's statement about the number of cases that have been dismissed, there were seven countries dismissed. There were not seven cases dismissed. Unless I'm mistaken, the only cases that have reported decisions that deal with this issue with regard to the foreign countries are Guatemala, which had several defendants, and Venezuela, which was the Florida State District Court decision that was affirmed on appeal there, which basically relied entirely on Guatemala.
And the principal case you rely on is the Texas trial.
Is the Texas case.
And your opponent has said that the Fifth Circuit has effectively overruled that case.
Well, they didn't overrule it at all in terms of directly. Now, if he's talking about other cases, he didn't refer to a citation, but he's saying that it's been overruled by subsequent jurisprudence. I'm not aware of what he means by that. The Texas case was won at the motion-to-dismiss level, and the tobacco company settled with Texas. And Texas had no statute, as he's discussed, that Florida had or a couple of the other states had. That was strictly a result of the Texas Federal District Court applying the Holmes factors from the United States Supreme Court case in an entirely different way than what was done in Guatemala by Judge Friedman. And I'm not saying that Judge Friedman's analysis isn't out there, but what I'm saying is that you have two judges, two different courts, basically, which provide most of the guidance we have in looking at remoteness in this issue, and they reach two different results.
So is the Texas case an Erie case? That is, was the court applying Texas law?
Yes, the court was applying Texas law. And so what I would commend to the court is to look at the way that they've evaluated the Holmes factors, which basically they found that the three Holmes factors...
Time is up.
I'm done. Thank you very much, Your Honors. Appreciate it.
The court appreciates the arguments of the parties. We will take the matter under advisement and stand in recess.